Luke 16. Not sure if this is the most bizarre parable of Jesus, but it's close. If it's not number one, it's in the top five. And we'll explain that as we go. But we're going to start at verse 1, and we're going to read all the way to verse 13. Luke chapter 16, starting at verse 1. He also said to the disciples, "There was a rich man who had a manager, and charges were brought to him that this man was wasting his possessions. And he called him and said to him, 'What is this that I hear about you? Turn in the account of your management so that you can no longer be manager.' And the manager said to himself, 'What shall I do? Since my master is taking the management away from me, I am not strong enough to dig, and I am too ashamed to beg. I've decided what to do, so that when I am removed from management, people may receive me into their houses.' So summoning my master's debtors one by one, he said to the first, 'How much do you owe my master?' He said, 100 measures of oil. He said to him, 'Take your bill, sit down quickly, and write 50. Where am I? There we go. Then he said to another, 'And how much do you owe?' He said, 100 measures of wheat. He said to him, 'Take your bill and write 80. The master commended the dishonest manager for his shrewdness. That's the one that kind of messes with us, right? For the sons of the world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. And I tell you, make friends for yourself by means of unrighteous wealth, so that when it fails, they may receive you into eternal dwellings. One who is faithful in a little, very little is also faithful in much, and one who is dishonest in a very little is also dishonest in much. If then you have not been faithful in the unrighteous wealth, who will entrust you with the true riches? And if you have not been faithful in that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money." Now, a person can use their money to... Carl, do we have that spotlight up here? A little bit nicer for my... There we go, my tired old eyes. There we go. Also makes me have a nice halo on the video, right? Person can use their money to win friends or make enemies, right? Some of you guys that are basketball fans will remember the name Latrell Sprewell. Latrell's a professional basketball player who played, he's retired now, he played 13 seasons in the NBA for teams like the Golden State Warriors, the New York Knicks, and the Minnesota Timberwolves. And he was a four-time All-Star who reached the NBA Finals in 1999. Other than being a prolific scorer, Sprewell's rather famous for two incidents. In 1997, he choked and then punched his coach, P.J. Carlissimo, out of practice, resulting in a 68-game suspension. The other incident happened at the end of his career while he was playing with the Minnesota Timberwolves. He was offered a contract extension for the next 3 years, which paid him $21 million. Now, that seems like a lot of money, but it was a substantial pay cut from his previous contract. Sprewell's outraged at the contract terms. He took his anger public. And so when a reporter asked him why he didn't just try to help his team win a championship first and then worry about getting a better contract, he famously is quoted as saying, "Why would I want to help them win a title? They're not doing anything for me. I'm at risk. I have a lot of risk here. I've got my family to feed." Needless to say, with a pay cut, $21 million should be enough to feed his family. What do you think? Maybe, yeah. With inflation, that might not, you know, maybe, you know. Who knows? But you know what? When your money is your life, you never think you have enough, even if it's $21 million. Rather than using it to do some spiritual good or make some everlasting friends in the process, when your money is your life, you just end up wasting it on yourself. And that begs the question, what should we do with our money? In our parable for this morning, Jesus starts with a very curious example. and then draws out some lessons to his disciples about how they should use their money. So we're in the midst of a sermon series entitled Stories with Intent, right? It's on the parables of Jesus. And Jesus' parables are stories set in real life in ancient Israel, but parables are not just stories. They're stories with intent. There's an intent there to teach us something, something about God, something about salvation, something about ourselves, something about our heavenly future, and they intend to prompt us to action, right? To move our hearts to respond to the lessons of the parable. Now, this week's parable, as I mentioned, is one of the more difficult parables that we have in the Gospels. It's the parable of it's often called the shrewd manager. And the story has kind of perplexed readers for a century. We read it and we wondered why in the world Jesus' parable commends a guy that is so obviously dishonest. Right? I mean, taken by itself, the parable is indeed strange, but when it's taken in context, though, when you read the verses after it, in light of those verses that follow, we begin to see the point that Jesus wants to communicate. And here's what Jesus wants to understand. He wants us to understand that believers should use earthly treasure to store up heavenly treasure. We should use earthly treasure to store up heavenly treasures. Disciples should learn from the world who act boldly and decisively as they try to ensure their earthly future. We, in turn, should act just the same way, boldly, decisively, to ensure our heavenly future. Now, before we begin, let's get our terms right, right? Since we're going to use the word shrewd rather frequently in this message, let's make sure we're all on the same page as to its meaning. Here's what dictionary.com says means shrewd means, right? Shrewd is having or showing astute or sharp judgment in practical matters, sometimes at the cost of moral compromise. So shrewdness is can be neutral, right? It can be positive, but it also can be negative. And we tend to think of shrewdness as a negative thing. It's usually not a comment if someone tells you you're shrewd, right? It doesn't always have to be, though. As we're going to see, the manager in our story is shrewd in a negative way. But then Jesus, in the verses following, tells believers we should be shrewd in a different way, a positive way, a shrewdness that shows our focus to be on eternal things rather than earthly things. So our passage breaks up into two units this morning. The first in Luke chapter 16, halfway through 8a, should be entitled How to Use Your Wealth for Earthly Purposes. How to use wealth for earthly purposes. Because that's really what this shrewd manager is doing. He's taking his wealth, he's manipulating the thing, and he's using it to guarantee his own earthly future. So if you want a lesson on how to use wealth to make your life on earth better, the shrewd manager provides us with that lesson. The story begins with two men. All right, there's a rich man who owned an estate or maybe a business and a manager or steward who managed the estate or the business for him, right? So apparently the rich man is a little bit not privy to the day-to-day affairs of his property, of his management. You know, he's maybe a distant, maybe he's got multiple estates and this is just one of them and he lives somewhere else. We don't really know, but the steward is hired to be responsible for these day-to-day decisions, making legal transactions, contracts for goods and services. All of this stuff is in the hands of the steward. And so the day comes when the rich man is told by someone else that his manager is being wasteful with his possessions. The word wasteful here, this is the same word we saw last week when the Bible described the prodigal son and how he wasted his dad's money. This is the same word. So this guy is squandering the rich man's possessions. He's squandering the rich man's wealth. And we're not sure how this is happening. You know, as we see, the steward kept pretty good records, so he's not incompetent. But on some level, he is guilty of mismanagement or wastefulness in some way. Now, the charges against the steward come from someone else. Maybe it's a business partner of the rich man, someone who dealt with the steward regularly. We don't really know. But the rich man hears that the steward is wasteful, and so he demands that the steward turn in his account books because he can no longer be manager. Notice the steward doesn't argue the charges, right? So we're thinking that he's guilty. He's not arguing that he's innocent somehow, you know. So the end result, as soon as the account books are handed in, will be that the steward will be out of a job. He's going to hand these account books in, and he's going to be fired. That's going to be the end. So in the following verses, Jesus makes us privy to the steward's thoughts as he tries to find a solution to this sudden crisis in his life. Now you got to remember, this is a world, there's no welfare, there's no unemployment. You lose your job, you got nothing. There's no government safety net here. You know, you got to find something else. You got to figure out some way to make this work for you, okay? So the word of his firing is going to get around, and he needs to act quickly to secure his earthly future after his job is terminated. As verse 3 makes clear, in his mind, his options are limited, right? What does the Bible say? He says, no one's going to hire a wasteful manager, okay? He knows that. In addition, he says in the Bible, he's thinking, right? Jesus is privy to his thoughts. He decides he is not physically robust enough to spend the rest of his life digging ditches or doing manual labor. I can't do that, he says. And I'm too ashamed to beg. I'm too proud for that, right? I can't beg for a living. So what am I going to do? Verse 4, the light bulb in his head turns on. Dink, right? And he decides what to do. And he's come up with this plan, and he's going to use this window of opportunity that he has before the estate's books are turned over to the owner to create some kind of circumstance where, once he is out of work, people will invite them to his homes. To their homes, sorry. How's this guy going to do this? This guy is shrewd. Notice there's no mention of repentance here. There's no recognition of sin before God. All right, this guy is operating on a purely earthly level here. He has decided how to manipulate earthly wealth to ensure his earthly future. And the plan is, you can find the plan in verses 5 to 7. He summons his master's debtors into his office one by one, right? He asks them each to declare what they owe to the master, reminding them of the depth and the value of their debt. And then he tells them to reduce the bill substantially, having them rewrite their promissory note in their own writing for a new amount. And so the end result is they owe the rich man less, but they are now obligated to the manager, right? See that? They owe the manager a huge favor. This manager is now in their debt. They are in debt, sorry, to the manager. They owe him some kind of obligation because he has erased a portion of their debt. Now, we're not sure how the manager does this. This is one of those places where there's lots of possibilities. We don't really know how this happens, right? You know, there's lots of theories. Some suggest the rich man was charging interest illegally to his fellow Jews, and the part of the debt that was cut by the manager was that illegal interest. That's one possibility, right? Others suggest the manager had buried some kind of hefty commission for himself in those contracts. And so when they were rewritten, he eliminates his own commission. And all that's left is just the kind of what is owed, the bare bones of what is owed. You know, still others say, well, you know, he just reduced the debt. I mean, to the master's direct loss, he just cut this debt 20%, 50%, whatever it was, he cut it down. And it's kind of hard to decide between those options. We really don't know how this guy does this and how he gets away with this. But here's the main point. Here's the faux thing we want to remember, right? The manager acted decisively and shrewdly to manipulate his master's books, and in doing so created a whole group of debtors who now owed him a substantial favor. That's where the shrewdness comes in. All right, that's where the shrewdness comes. These are all people who could, when the manager was out of a job and on the street, take him in, house him as a guest, and even perhaps provide work for him in some way. We got two examples of this manipulation in the text, right? Verse 6, if you look at the text, the debtor owes 100 measures of oil. That's about 875 gallons of oil. That's a yield of nearly 150 olive trees. The cost of this oil is about 1,000 denarii, or about 3 years' work for a laborer. The steward knocks this bill in half, writing a new contract for the revised amount. The second example is in verse 7. This man owes 100 measures of wheat, which is about 1,100 bushels, 39,000 liters of grain. This is the yield from about 100 acres of farmland. The debt is about 2,500 to 3,000 denarii, 8 to 10 years of labor for an average worker. It's a huge debt. And the steward reduces his bill by 20%. And so you can kind of picture the process, right? Each debtor is called into the manager's office. Each debt is reduced substantially in some way. They each write their own promissory note in their own hand, so it looks like all of this is legitimate, right? And each debtor is now in the master's debt. His earthly future is secure because this huge number of people owe him an equally huge favor. And all of this on an earthly perspective makes perfect sense, doesn't it? I mean, think about it this way. Suppose you get a certified letter in the mail from your bank or your mortgage company. It's never going to happen, but let's just imagine, okay? You know, the letter asks you to come by their office for a meeting, all right? So you come by the office, and at that meeting, they ask you to state how much you owe on your mortgage, $50,000, $100,000, $150,000, maybe more than that, who knows? And then they say they're going to cut that debt in half for you. How are you feeling in that moment? Other than a little doubtful. Maybe they have to pick you up off the floor. I don't know, right? How are you feeling? If it's real, how do you feel? Euphoric, overjoyed, appreciative? Maybe not appreciative enough to have the bank manager move into my house if he gets fired, right? Maybe not that appreciative, but you're appreciative nonetheless, right? That's the picture here. Okay, that's the picture. This is what this manager has done over and over and over. He has secured his earthly future with each and every debtor that he has helped for the day that he is one day out of a job, which is coming very soon. And so the first half of verse 8, that's often what throws people for a loop when you read this parable. This is the last phrase of the parable, and at face value, it's kind of a shocking statement. You know, the master commended the dishonest manager for his shrewdness. The rich man applauds the steward for his shrewd, decisive, astute decision-making. Yes, he still calls him a dishonest manager. Notice that in the text, right? He's not thinking this guy's above board on any level. He's still a dishonest manager, but and likely the rich man lost a lot of money. But the owner cannot help admire the rogue who secured his future after his firing at his expense. Now, if Jesus ended the story right here, had nothing else to say after that, ended the story right here, what's the lesson going to be of this parable? Crime does pay, probably something like that, right? I mean, you know, that if we stop right there, that's our lesson for today. There you go. You can all go home. But this parable doesn't line up with Jesus' teaching as it stands, right? It doesn't line up with Jewish law. It doesn't line up with general morality. The steward's a crook who is commended for his shrewd dealings. What in the world are we going to learn from this parable? We need to keep reading to find out, because Jesus puts it in context for us. If verses 1 to 8 were about how to use wealth for earthly purposes, the rest of the passage is about how to use wealth for eternal purposes. In these verses, Jesus draws out three lessons for believers from the parable of the shrewd manager. In light of the parable of the shrewd manager, Jesus wants his disciples to be shrewd with their earthly wealth. But as followers of Jesus, our focus isn't on our earthly futures with our earthly wealth, right? It's on our heavenly future. And so he wants us to use wealth to store up heavenly treasure that will be eternal rather than eternal treasure that will ultimately, I mean, so rather than earthly treasure, sorry, that will ultimately pass away. Now, maybe this sounds a little bit weird to you. You know, maybe if you're not careful, you might want to think, you know, firstly, Jesus, this sounds kind of like salvation by works here. You know, it sounds a little fishy to say that how we use our money here will determine our future destiny in heaven. Now, here's how we want to look at this, all right? How we use our money that God has given us is an indication of the orientation of our hearts. Our hearts are either oriented in a heavenly or an earthly way. Either we live for this life or we live for the next. Either we have decided we are only going around once, so we're going to indulge in whatever we can get our hands on, or we decide that the real investment in our life should be on eternal things. So how we use our money here, what Jesus is saying, is evidence of the orientation of our heart either toward God or the world. Believers in Jesus Christ have placed their trust in Jesus Christ, right? They believe Jesus died on the cross for their sins. They believed he was raised to life to give them new eternal life. They have given their lives to him. And so when it comes to handling money, we recognize first that every possession we have is not ours, right? It's a gift from God. And in light of that, a heart oriented on God is going to want to please God with our possessions and spend them in a way that will have an eternal impact on our lives and the lives of others around us. That's really what Jesus is saying here. So how can we use our wealth for eternal purposes? As I said, first, there's three lessons here. Here's the first. Use your wealth to make eternal friends. Use your wealth to make eternal friends. What does that mean? We'll find out, right? Jesus begins by noting that the sons of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. What's Jesus saying here? The people who have a purely earthly orientation, right? The sons of this world are more decisive and astute in dealing with wealth than people who have a heart orientation toward God. And honestly, I think that it's very true. This should not be a shocker to anyone, really. I mean, think for a minute of the lengths that worldly people go to make a buck. Think of the lengths that worldly people go to ensure their earthly future. Think of the energy worldly people put into the pursuit of money. They work long hours. They study the markets. They carefully nurture their assets. They grow their portfolios. They grow their business from the ground up. They sacrifice their marriages and their families just for the almighty dollar, right? And they do so for what? Temporary, material gain. They are very, very shrewd in setting themselves up for their earthly futures. And Jesus is basically saying, if only believers had the same kind of commitment to use wealth for eternal purposes. If only we were as shrewd, as energetic, as zealous, as wise, as decisive with regard to eternal or everlasting things. All too often, children of light see wealth as something just for this world. We are not shrewd in how we use it, and we do not use it for eternal purposes. And Jesus wants us to correct that. Look at verse 9. Jesus says, I tell you, a phrase which, of course, is meant to draw our focus onto what follows, right? I tell you, make friends for yourself by means of unrighteous wealth, so when it fails, not if it fails, when it fails, right, they may receive you into eternal dwellings. Now, first thing you want to notice here is, for Jesus, wealth is an unrighteous thing. Jesus doesn't really see money as neutral in his teaching. There is always a danger attached to money for him. Wealth is unrighteous in its trustworthy, and it deceives us with false promises. We all live in a world where we earn and use this unrighteous wealth. We cannot escape that. Unless you're going to move to a monastery somewhere, we cannot avoid it. So what do we do with that as Christians? Jesus says we want to use it to make friends who will receive us into eternity. So the shrewd manager, remember him, right? The shrewd manager comes up with a plan to put people in his debt so they could take him into their homes, so he has his earthly future secure. Shrewd believers use their wealth to make friends who will welcome them into God's home and make their eternal future secure. See the difference? See what Jesus is trying to tell us, right? The shrewd manager, he's all about the world, right? How can I manipulate the books so that people owe me so my earthly future is secure? Believers, we want to use our money in a similar way, shrewdly, decisively, wisely, smartly, but for different purposes. To have people, affect people eternally so that people will welcome us into God's home. Our eternal future will be secure. Now, a couple questions come to mind, right? First of all, who are these friends, right? We're not sure. This is another place in this parable. There's lots and lots of opinions, okay? Some see this as an oblique reference to God. Others see it referring to angels. Still others see it as a reference to people who are internally impacted by how we use our money on earth. And if I had to make a choice, I'd probably lean toward the last choice there, right? We ought to use our money to invest eternally in the lives of others so that when we get to heaven, there will be eternal evidence of our shrewd money management. So if these people are we invest in now, so if these are people, sorry, that we invest in now, how do we make eternal friends? What does that look like? Well, we use our money in eternal ways, ways that are contrary to consumer culture. It was a great day of mourning in my house when I found out that Sam Waterston, the creator of Calvin and Hobbes, was hanging up his pen or whatever he would have, right? Still my favorite comic strip. And now Dawson's starting to, he's making me sit down and explain them to him. Not sure he gets most of them, but he thinks it's fun to have Dad explain Calvin and Hobbes to him, right? So, and if you ever read Calvin and Hobbes has, the guy has an incisive take on life. We're not sure if it's Sam's or Calvin's or whatever, right? But he's just kind of has this ability to see the truth in life. So here's a great comic strip, right? Here's this strip. Calvin has just made one of his proverbial snowmen. If you read Calvin and Hobbes a lot, he makes a lot of really weird snowmen, okay? And so his stuffed animal friend Hobbes remarks that the snowman doesn't look very happy. And Calvin remarks, well, he's not. He knows it's just a matter of time before he melts. The sun ignores his entreaties. He feels his existence is meaningless, okay? So this is like a philosophical question. You know, he is melting. He is going to be gone pretty soon. His existence is meaningless. Is his existence meaningless, asks Hobbes? Oh, no, Calvin says. He's about to buy a big screen TV. Right? You know, so good for the snowman. I'm glad he has his priorities right. You know, here he is melting. He's dying. But he's going to get a big screen TV. He's going to be able to see his programs on a great, great set. Like the snowman, it is so frequent that people, when they know they're running out of time, they spend more on themselves. You ever notice that? Ever notice that? Who are the people with bucket lists who are frantically trying to fill their bucket lists? It's not the 20-somethings. It's the 60-somethings, right? Oh, I got to go here. I got to go there. I got to get this all in. How about the guy that's driving down the road with a massive motorhome with a bumper sticker that says, I'm spending my kid's inheritance? Right? Ever seen a few of those? You know, worldly people, when they know their time is short, it's like they got to cram in more stuff. But Christians, because they know the time is short as well, because they know wealth will one day fail them, there's no question about that, right? We want to invest in eternal things. We want to make forever friends by supporting a gospel-preaching church and its ministries, right? We want to make forever friends by sending and supporting missionaries, by funding Bible translation or Christian treatment centers like Teen Challenge, who was here a couple weeks ago, right? Or shortwave or internet radio broadcasts of the gospel or whatever it is, right? We want to make forever friends by hosting friends and neighbors in our homes and using our time and our possessions to serve others and being generous to those in need. We invest in things and people for eternal reasons in ways that hopefully will bring us eternal results. That's the first lesson, right? Use your money for eternal purposes. Make eternal friends with your money. Here's the second lesson in these verses. Jesus tells us to use our wealth to display faithful character. Use your wealth as evidence of your faithfulness. Wealth can be a tool that evidences our faithfulness, mirrored after God's faithfulness and planted in our lives by the ministry of the Holy Spirit, right? The faithfulness is this fruit of the Spirit. Jesus wants us to remember that character is character, even when one is dealing with little things. There are no small things when it comes to integrity. There's nothing we can write off as, oh, that's no big deal. Right? What does he say in verse 10? Faithfulness in small things is evidence that one will be faithful in larger things. And the opposite is true. The person who is dishonest in little things will be dishonest in bigger things. These figures terrified me. There was a survey of 70,000 high school students in 2020, so just a couple years ago, revealed that 68% of high school students in America had cheated on a test. 58% had plagiarized, and 95% had participated in some form of cheating. 95%! The figures drop a little bit when you ask college students the same questions. But let's just think about the ramifications of that. We have a whole generation who is not faithful in small things. Right? What's going to happen when they're entrusted with larger things? That's what's going to happen. They're going to graduate from college or high school, and they're going to get jobs. They're going to handle real money or have real people's lives in under their care. What's going to happen? You know, the old saying tells us, don't sweat the small stuff, right? Well, that's not quite accurate, because Jesus says how we handle the small stuff reveals how we will handle the big stuff. Jesus continues in verse 11. If you've not been faithful in unrighteous wealth, who will entrust to you true riches? In other words, if you can't handle the unrighteous, very temporary things of earth, why should we be entrusted with true riches, eternal things? The person who uses their money in the wrong way shows themselves unfit to handle more important things. And he piles on more in verse 12, right? In case we don't have enough, right? If you have not been faithful in that which is another's, who will give you what is your own? Now, we expect Jesus to say the opposite thing here. We expect him to say, if you can't handle your own stuff, you're never going to be trusted with something belonging to others. But that's not what Jesus says here. Because why? Because there is nothing in this world that we truly own. Everything belongs to God. Everything we have is another's. Everything we own, every car we drive, every house we live in, every cent in our bank accounts is a loan from God. We are stewards of what he has given us. And so if we cannot handle what we have been loaned, why should God give us eternal possessions? And these are hard questions, and they're meant to be hard questions. How we handle our wealth, our possessions here in this life, gives evidence to our character. We either display a character that is worldly and earthly in nature, or we display a character that is God-oriented and eternal in nature. If we are faithful before God with a small amount of money and possessions we have now, investing them eternally, we will be given much larger eternal things in heaven. Finally, in third, in verse 13, last lesson, use your wealth to demonstrate godly priorities. Use your wealth to demonstrate godly priorities. Again, this is a verse about the orientation of our heart, right? He says a servant can have two masters, but a servant cannot serve both masters equally. One master must become more important than the other. You hate one and you love the other. You're devoted to one, despise the other. Or as Jesus makes very clear in this context, right, you cannot serve either God and money. You cannot serve them both equally. On one level, one of those will be the king. It's impossible to serve them equally. One must take precedence. So this verse like this asks us, where's our heart oriented, right? Is it oriented toward earthly things? Have our possessions, our bank accounts become our idols? And I get it. All you guys would say, no way, not me. But think about it this way. Think back to your conversations, for example, with your spouse. What usually characterizes your decisions? What are your conversations about? Your house, shopping, new car, next vacation? What are we going to buy next? Or what do you talk about with your friends? Oh, have you seen my new? Let me show you this. It's so cool. There are many times where our conversations are going to tell the truth, a truth that maybe our minds and our hearts might not want to admit. It's so very easy to get tied up in earthly things, to set our lives so that money, possessions, and what we serve what gives us satisfaction, what makes the world go around for us. Jesus knows the spiritual power of material things. Money and possessions have the power to dominate our hearts. They have the power to become the gods of our life. That is what the warning is here. There is no middle ground either here, right? You can't straddle the fence. You either serve God or you serve money. Our hearts only have the capacity for one dominating love. Now, this doesn't mean we can't spend some of your money on yourself. It doesn't mean Christians can never be wealthy. That's not what Jesus is saying here. It does mean, though, that we must first surrender everything we have on loan from God to God so that He can use what we've been given the way He wants us to use it. Don't let your money master you. But bring yourself and everything you have under the mastery of Jesus, right? And you might, some of you might think, well, this really sounds bad. It sounds weird. I don't know if I can do this. It sounds like my life is going to be miserable. It sounds like Jesus is trying to rob me of my joy. In fact, just the opposite. Jesus offers us an eternal joy that will be with us far beyond this life. Far beyond, long after your car is rusted in a junkyard, long after your house is ruled by a slumlord, long after this nation ceases to exist and your bank account is empty, whatever it is, I mean, there's still going to be joy in Jesus. And what kind of joy can your house offer you? Maybe joy until the first repair is needed. Joy until, you know, the impact of that mortgage payment really hits your wallet. Or how about your new car? How much joy is that going to give you? Joy until it gets its first scratch, right? Or maybe the odometer rolls up a little bit higher, or maybe that morning it won't start. Joy's gone. How about that new purchase? How much joy is that going to give you? If you're typical, that joy is going to last until something new or shinier comes along. Something else you can buy. Oh yeah, that's even better. All these things are earthly joys, right? There's joy attached to them, but it is so temporary. It is so fleeting. They are so very, very temporary. They do not last. They cannot last. And so Jesus is saying here, why settle for something like that when we have a Savior that offers Himself to us for eternity? Believers should use their earthly treasure shrewdly to store up heavenly treasure. Be wise, be astute, be decisive with your wealth, but use it for eternal purposes, right? Make eternal friends with it. Use it to demonstrate your faithful character so that when the day comes, greater things will be entrusted to you. And show your priorities with how you use your wealth. Priorities, yes, that run contrary to the world's priorities. I get that. By serving God with your money rather than serving yourself with your money. Remember, how we use our money shows the orientation of our hearts. God has gifted us with money. He's gifted us with possessions. They are loaned to us in this life. Let's invest them in eternal things, and in so doing, bring glory to God, have eternal impact on earth, and secure for ourselves treasures in heaven. Praise team, if you guys want to come up and lead us in a closing song, and then we will close in prayer and be dismissed this morning.